It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us in our Ames studio, Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
And in Cedar Falls, Donna Hoffman. Let's see if we have her dial turned up in Cedar Falls. Donna, are you there?
I am here.
Excellent. Both of you on board. Donna Hoffman is Associate Professor, Head of the Department of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Our two analysts this week to chew over some of the latest developments on the political landscape. And we'd also like to have you join in. This is the final Politics Wednesday of 2016. Next year, week, there is another Wednesday, of course, in this year. Next week, we'll have some special programming on Wednesday. So this is our last Politics Wednesday. And so we're reaching out to you, our regular political listeners on Wednesdays. In six words or less, what is your takeaway from the 2016 political year? Tell us, six words or less, your takeaway from the 2016 political year. I have a conversation going on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page currently right now. Some of the responses, let's hope we don't regret this election. One response, Trump, Pence, make America great again. Another response, wait, it wasn't a bad dream. Another response, can we throw out both parties? And it's always been a representative republic. Six words or less, that's your challenge for this hour. Go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Or, of course, you can call up with any question you have. As we're in this period now with the President-elect Donald Trump and the final days of an eight-year administration under President Barack Obama. Donna and Dave, I'd like to have you react to some of the top news. Let's go to Europe, first of all. We just heard in the news the Berlin Christmas market, 12 people dying there on Monday, at least 48 people wounded. A target of terrorism, according to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Police searching now for a Tunisian man in connection with the attack. Questions raised about his possible ties to Islamist extremism, ISIS claiming responsibility for this. Donna, how is the attack likely to influence the discussion about terrorism in this country?
Well, I mean, I think anytime you have an attack overseas, in which we've seen a recent one in Turkey, we see this one in Germany, it certainly, and especially given the environment in Europe right now and some of the parallels here in the United States, it causes people to talk more about Islamic terrorism and things that are going on in terms of immigration policies, both in Europe, which is certainly under big discussion, and which also was part of the discussion here in the United States as well. But then, you know, there's also things going on in the Middle East, in Syria in particular, and none of these things are isolated. They're all essentially related. And so it feeds into an overall discussion that we've had in the United States for a really pretty long time that certainly elevated to a new level in the aftermath of September 11th, in which Americans become increasingly concerned about being victims of terrorist attacks. But yet we still know statistically that you're very, very unlikely to be the victim of such an attack. But nevertheless, that is exactly what terrorism is supposed to do, right? Make you afraid to go Christmas shopping, make you afraid to go out in public. And so to the extent that, you know, we have these discussions, then another question is, you know, how safe do Americans feel when they go out and do everyday regular things?
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson, I wonder if we should expect a vastly different approach to fighting terrorism once Donald Trump is sworn in?
Well, I think that largely remains to be seen because we're not sure how to fight terrorism differently. The small-scale attacks that we're seeing in Europe right now are really difficult to stop. This is no longer the kind of warfare where soldiers are wearing uniforms and can be identified. Terrorist attacks could arrive from anybody, and they can arrive anywhere. And kind of the point of terrorism is that you always go for the soft spots in a society. It is nearly impossible as a society to guard everything. There's always got to be some level of freedom, some level of access for the public. And if terrorists can use this, it's just maddening to figure out how to defend yourself against it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the Trump administration are going to try new tactics and new strategies. But at this point, we're really unsure of what those are going to look like.
Mm-hmm. How do we evaluate the Obama administration in fighting terrorism? Well, since 9/11, the record's been pretty good about preventing terrorist attacks on American soil, hasn't it, Donna?
Yeah, it's actually been relatively good in terms of looking at attacks and the number of people killed and those kinds of things. But certainly they do happen. And, you know, we have all kinds of different attacks. We have San Bernardino that happened last year, the Pulse nightclub. And again, the larger point that Dave is making is that in a free and open society, you are going to be susceptible to these kinds of things. And the question becomes, is how much of an infringement on your freedom are you willing to take to be 100% safe? And you can't even be 100% safe, but to elevate that percentage. And that's really a question that the Obama administration has wrestled with before it, the Bush administration wrestled with, and the Trump administration will wrestle with as well.
Mm-hmm. And we have a number of generals in the cabinet here put forth by President-elect Donald Trump, Secretary of Defense, Marine General James Mattis, Defense Secretary, others there. I guess this is a time. Have we ever, Dave, do you know, have we ever seen so many generals in a cabinet?
I'm not really sure that we have, but we also, we have a kind of larger military base right now. The size of the Defense Department has grown, which means you have more agency heads to put in. You have the new Department of Homeland Security, which implicitly says we should care about defense. So it kind of creates more openings for military leadership. I'm not sure that we've seen this level of leadership from the military join into a new administration. But I think part of it is the changing complexion of the administration.
Mm-hmm. Homeland Security Secretary put forth Marine General John Kelly, another general, retired Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, put forward as the White House National Security Advisor. Let's go to actions by the president yesterday, current President Barack Obama, for another 30 or so days. He designated the bulk of U.S.-owned waters in the Arctic Ocean, certain areas in the Atlantic Ocean, as indefinitely off-limits to future oil and gas leasing. It's a move that adds to the president's environmental legacy. We know this is very important to him. At the same time, sort of a test to the president-elect's promise to unleash the nation's untapped energy reserves. I'm not sure if that's exactly his words, but pretty much. Donna, here, do you see this as a challenge here, or what is the president doing here? I mean, certainly trying to protect the environment, do what he believes in.
And I do think he's trying to further his environmental legacy, as you mentioned here, with this. You know, I don't know that it's a direct, he's setting himself up for a direct confrontation with the new administration coming in, even though they have different opinions on how the environment should be protected. But, you know, it is the administration has been talking about this memorandum that the president signed as being permanent. And I think that's a little bit questionable. There's no, in terms of the law that they're operating under, there's no provision in that law for how you would take lands out once they were protected here. But certainly Congress could change that. And a new president potentially could come in and try to do that with another memorandum, and that then would likely spark some legal challenges. So this is probably not an area that we are going to see go away anytime soon. And you know, really, will the Trump administration take this as, you know, the Obama administration kind of throwing down the gauntlet and daring them to try this? Could be.
Mm-hmm. The White House announcing these actions in conjunction with the Canadian government, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, also placed a moratorium on new oil and gas leasing in its Arctic waters. What is your view on this, Dave? Can it be easily undone by a President Trump?
In the first 2 years, I think so, because really an act of Congress will always overturn this. Obama is relying upon a current act of Congress, the 1935 law, and a new Congress could just simply rewrite a new 2017 law. So it could be overdone. I think the big question, though, is Trump going to have an interest in doing so? The action that Obama took did not affect current leases, and the fact is that I don't think any existing oil company is using an existing oil lease in the Arctic because it's just not profitable right now. Mm-hmm. Drilling for oil is very expensive up there. It's very risky, and oil companies have admitted through climate change that it's becoming even more difficult, and it's just not profitable to do so. And in some ways, this is kind of a symbolic action. It does protect the environment up there, but at this point, there really isn't much push to do exploration for natural resources up there because companies aren't making money off of it.
When we look at Donald Trump's cabinet as a whole, though, we do see definitely a different approach to the environment, don't we, Donna, than Barack Obama, Energy Secretary, former Texas Governor Rick Perry, the EPA Administrator put forward, an Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt.
They certainly have a different view in terms of energy, and especially, I mean, both Oklahoma and Texas are oil states. Their economies rely heavily on that industry. And, you know, with an Obama administration, there was kind of this all of the above strategy in terms of forwarding both traditional energy, which we also saw boom with fracking in those states and in other places in the United States and Canada, which is one of the reasons why gasoline and oil comparatively are relatively low right now, because there is a lot of supply out there. And so it'll be interesting to see, I think, what the Trump administration's actions will be in this area, given the nature of relatively low oil prices, and then how they're going to try to both talk about but then act on climate change, because there are certainly are some people that appear to be going into Trump's cabinet that have very differing views in terms of whether climate change is a hoax perpetrated on the American people, as one senator from Oklahoma once said, or if it's backed up by scientific evidence.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined our conversation, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Donna Hoffman from the University of Northern Iowa with us in our Cedar Falls studio and our AIM studio. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. Join our conversation. What are your hopes? What are your fears for the coming year under a Trump administration? Also, we're going to be talking a little bit of Iowa politics later on, the first time since the 1990s that the Republicans have both houses of legislature in Iowa, as well as the governor's office. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. On our Facebook page, a nice lively conversation. The challenge put forth in six words or less: what is your takeaway from this year that is almost in the past, from the political year 2016? Six words or less. We'll be sharing some of those a little bit later as well. On Monday, President-elect Donald Trump cleared the 270-vote threshold needed to defeat Hillary Clinton in the Electoral College. I guess the tally of defectors, 7, choosing someone other than Trump or Clinton. Dave Anderson, what jumped out at you about that Electoral College vote? It's to remind ourselves, it's not a college. It doesn't exist anywhere. It happens in all 50 states, right?
Yeah, it happens everywhere. What jumps out is that people actually paid attention to it this year. It is usually just in kind of a forgotten formality. But this year people paid attention because there was so much bitterness on both sides of the aisle that people were hoping for something we've never seen before, which is the Electoral College acting independently of the popular vote. It was never likely to happen, but it did make kind of an interesting sideshow. And we did see some intentional faithless electors this time. That is unusual and really is not necessarily something you want to promote, because the last thing I think anybody in America wants is to have two presidential elections, one a popular vote in November and then a completely independent Electoral College vote in December. That causes problems.
We heard in the top of the hour news this is evidently still under the president-elect's skin. He's saying now the Electoral College, he campaigned to win the Electoral College vote, and he said that winning that vote is tougher than the popular vote. And anyway, he says he still disputes that he lost the popular vote. Donna Hoffman, first of all, why wasn't the campaign to have more electors defect more successful?
Well, because, you know, the system is fairly decentralized, and, you know, they don't all meet in the same place, as you noted. And there's the founders were very strategic. They didn't want them meeting in the same place because they would be more subject to intrigue from foreign agents, if you will. And so so it's very decentralized. There was never really any kind of there were attempts here, as you noted, but nothing ever really gained steam. And you know, what would have happened if Donald Trump had not gotten to 270 and if Hillary Clinton had not gotten to 270? It would have gone to the House of Representatives, where each state gets one vote. The Republicans would have dominated that, and it's highly likely they would have picked Trump anyway. Now, they could have picked another Republican, depending on what the dynamics there were, but probably they were going to pick Trump. And so that's one of the reasons, I think, why you didn't see any kind of steam building up in that movement. And, you know, we do contest elections based on rules, and the rules are such that We take a popular vote. It has an effect on the Electoral College vote, but it's not a one-to-one effect, and the Electoral College is the thing that elects the president. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of discussion. And then you also, again, with the decentralized system, some states bind their electors, some do not. Even the states that bind their electors, those are potentially subject to constitutional challenge. And so there was just a lot of complexity here, a lot of gray, and it just didn't gain any steam. And, you know, one of the reasons why it didn't gain any steam is that over time, in this last 18 months, we have seen slowly the Republican Party make their peace with Donald Trump, first as their nominee, and then go forward into the general election, and they got behind him. And so the discontented voices within the Republican Party came to be not all that loud, and they didn't ever get any kind of cooperation with the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. What of the future of the Electoral College in every other aspect of voting in the United States, when we vote for the executive in each state? It's the popular vote that puts him or her in that position. The president, the only one to have this this instrument, the Electoral College. Does this, Dave, put this attention that you called out there at the beginning of the show, put its future in question at all?
No, I don't think so. The Electoral College is very complicated. It is outdated, but it is a distinct feature of our constitutional government. And I think any attempt to change it brings up the even trickier question of, well, what do we go to next? A lot of people do love the idea of a national popular vote, but if we really start thinking about that, there's reasons not to want that, particularly if you live in Iowa. If we live in Iowa, if we go to a national popular vote without a large city here, it's unlikely we're ever going to see a presidential candidate again. If we get rid of the Electoral College, also our sequential primary system makes little sense, so then we would lose the Iowa caucuses. Suddenly, if we just go to a national popular vote, politicians are only going to go to the big cities. They're only going to go to the major TV markets. And
wouldn't that make sense? Okay, let's just have the parallel to the election of governors in various states. Governors are elected by popular vote in whatever state they're seeking office. So they go all over the state, right? Charles Grassley does his 99-county tour, right?
Absolutely. And if you're in Iowa, you can go to all 99 counties. But if you are Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, you're not going to be able to visit all 3,200-something counties in the United States. You're going to focus on the urban centers where a majority of the U.S. population is.
Mm-hmm. Donna, anything to add to that?
Well, you know, it's very unlikely that we'll get rid of the Electoral College, even if you don't like it. You might as well make your peace with it. Mm-hmm. Because it does give small states, like Iowa, a small advantage. And if you wanted to change the Electoral College, you wanted to get rid of it, you would have to amend the Constitution, even though there are a few workarounds that people have promoted to kind of get around it. You would have to amend the Constitution. There are enough small states in the ratification process that would fairly easily block that. And, you know, we had this situation where somebody wins a popular vote and somebody else wins the Electoral College, happened 16 years ago. And there was a little bit of talk about this, you know, very same issue, but nothing happened. And the same thing will happen here. I predict, because it's just incredibly hard to amend the Constitution, and then you do have to figure out what you're going to do, how you're going to elect the president after that. And there are a lot of different choices. It's not just sheer popular vote. And any electoral system, there is no perfect electoral system. A popular vote can bring us tyranny of the majority, for example. There is no perfect electoral system, and every electoral system has winners and losers. You just need to understand the electoral system. And that's, you know, you started off this segment with this tweet from Donald Trump about it was tougher to win the Electoral College, which I would dispute. But the point is that you compete under the rules that you are given. And the two candidates competed with the structural framework that the Electoral College gives us, which is that states matter. Not all states matter as much as other states. Swing states in particular matter most. Those are just what the rules give us, and those are the consequences that we have. You move to a different system, there are going to be different winners, different losers, different consequences.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea that's come up from time to time that when you go into the voting booth, you don't, it's not like an on or off switch. I vote for Donald Trump, I vote for Hillary Clinton or whoever in the primary, I vote for Bernie Sanders or whatever. It's a ranking. If you say, okay, if I had my druthers, in first place, I'll put Donald Trump. In second place, Bernie Sanders. In third place, Hillary Clinton. How does that, Dave, have you looked into that sort of voting at all? Does anybody in the world do their voting that way? And how does that change a campaign, do you think?
I believe Switzerland uses rank order voting. There is a country in Europe I know that does do it. And there are a lot of pluses to it, especially when you have a multi-party system. It really kind of makes sense. The problem in the United States is, of course, we don't have a multi-party system. We have a two-party system. And the two-party system is not just because we like the number two. It's because we have first-past-the-post elections, where whoever gets the most amount of votes wins, and the second-place winner gets absolutely nothing. If you go to a parliamentary system, where you have the people vote for a party and your party gets a percentage of seats in the legislature, then a rank order system makes a lot of sense. But it's very rare in the United States to have a situation where rank order voting really matters. We're talking about it right now because we just had a Republican primary that started out with, I think, 19 candidates. And in that situation, maybe rank order makes sense. But then you go from a rank order system in primaries to a what we're used to, traditional popular vote system in the general election, and that just gets very confusing for people.
What's your view on rank order voting?
There are pockets of it actually being used in the United States.
Really?
And it is something that is gaining some reformers to its ranks. But, you know, the San Francisco City Council uses ranked choice voting, for example. The problem that you have, it makes sense for some of the reasons Dave was talking about. The problem that you have is that it does take more voter education. Because you don't just go into your voting booth and pick your Democrat or Republican. You have to know who the candidates are. You have to know how much you like them and how little you like some of the other ones, and you have to be able to put them down in that order. So today in the United States, people go into the voting booth. They have a really good cue in terms of voting and its party, and they don't need to know each candidate. They don't need to know all of the stances that each candidate stands for most voters. Knowing that they're a Democrat or a Republican is all they need. When you go to ranked choice voting, that's not all you need to know. And you need to know a little bit more information because you can convey more information on those ballots. So you do have various constituencies across the United States because, again, we have this very decentralized system where we have local elections, state elections, school board elections, national, federal elections, all of these things. And there are different systems used in different places. So there are pockets in the United States where these experiments are going on. And they're relatively new, and so we don't really have good results in terms of how voters like them and their effectiveness in that regard. But it is gaining steam, I think. That needs to be put into perspective. Do I think it's going to, ever happen? No, but it is something that reformers have increasingly been looking at as something new and novel.
Okay, pondering alternatives to the Electoral College. With Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. When we come back on this Politics Wednesday, we'll talk about the debate over what type of investigations, perhaps, should be in the future in regards to the Russian hacking of the U.S. Elections. We'll come back in just a moment with more of Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer on River to River. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow on this program, we listen back to some more of the most memorable conversations from this program in the year 2016. We'll listen back to an interview, a conversation I had with a Decorah man who lost his home in flooding. A woman, an Iowa woman, who was protesting the pipeline, now completed, that crosses 18 states here in Iowa. Also, my conversation with an Elkader man reacting to that deadly mass shooting, the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history in Orlando in 2016. Also, gender equality from Gloria Steinem. I had a conversation with her a few months back. We'll hope you'll tune in for that. Listen back to some memorable conversations from this program in 2016. Dave Anderson with us, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University. Donna Hoffman with us. She's associate professor and head of the Department of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Yes, it's Politics Wednesday, the very last Politics Wednesday of 2016. That's why we're reaching out to you today. Six words or less, your takeaways from the 2016 political year. Go to our Facebook page, a number of people there joining in with our six-word challenge. For instance, Nate chiming in here, Democrats lose, then shed salty tears. His six words, Amy's six words, he who laughs last laughs best. Go to our Facebook page and join in with that challenge. Toward the end of this program, this half hour, I want to turn to Dave and Donna to have them tell us, not necessarily in six words, their big takeaways from the political year that almost was. Also, the questions they have looking forward into 2017. But first, let's talk about this. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell rejecting bipartisan calls for a special committee to investigate Russian interference in the election, which in U.S. intelligence says was aimed in part at helping Donald Trump defeat Hillary Clinton. McConnell saying the likely meddling by Russia is a serious issue, but it doesn't require a select committee. He says the Senate Intelligence Committee is able to investigate the matter. Now, these comments put him at odds with the Arizona Senator John McCain and other Republicans. They have joined with incoming Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, calling for a special committee, what is a select committee, to investigate efforts not only by Russia but China, Iran, to interfere in U.S. elections. Here's McCain, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, saying that interference in the election threatens to destroy democracy. Here he is in an interview this week with CNN's Jake Tapper on that program, State of the Union, sharing his concerns over hacking in the presidential election.
I have seen no evidence that the election would have been different, but that doesn't change the fact that the Russians and others, Chinese to a lesser degree, have been able to interfere with our electoral process. Whether how serious it is and whether it would have affected the outcome of the election or not is the reason why we need to have a select committee. Jake, the responsibilities for cyber is spread over about four different committees in the Senate, and each doing their own thing, frankly, is not going to be the most efficient way of arriving at a conclusion. This is serious business. If they're able to harm the electoral process, then they destroy democracy, which is based on free and fair elections.
Okay, Senator McCain from this week. Dave Anderson, explain to us, what is the disagreement over here among Republicans? Also, what is the difference between an investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee, which Mitch McConnell says is fine, that'll do the job here, and a special select committee, which Chuck Schumer and also we heard John McCain is wanting?
Sure. So this goes into one of these weedy topics that the public generally doesn't have to be aware of, that when we talk about Senate committees and House committees, people think of their elected representatives getting in a room talking about an issue. That's not really what a committee is. A committee involves those people, but beneath the water, there are dozens of staff members who are hired, who are experts in an area, who go out and try to investigate things that they then bring to their members' attention, and the members are the ones who talk about difficult issues, talk to specific experts, and try to make legislation. Every once in a while, a new topic will crop up in the United States, and it doesn't fit well into one of the existing committee structures. The expertise just isn't there. A good example is after the September 11th attacks, we weren't sure how to deal with domestic terrorism. We had armed services committees that worried about defending us from foreign attack, but that was mainly military-based. And we had judiciary committees that dealt with internal crime within the United States, but terrorism was really a hybrid of these two things. So they created a select intelligence committee to investigate Homeland Security, and they said, you know what, we need a whole new committee to focus on this. And there's an argument right now that cyber threats should be investigated like this. There are certain committees that deal with technology issues, which involves the internet and the cyber world. There are other committees that deal with Homeland Security and defense and armed services. But the threat of cyber warfare, and particularly cyber warfare aimed at our democratic processes, may be a whole new ballgame that we need to create a new apparatus to talk about. And I think one of the things that's wrapped up in this right now is the question of, are we talking about the 2016 interference, which a lot of Republicans do not want to talk about right now because it seems to put a taint on their victory in this year's election and also Donald Trump's election? Or are we talking about cyber warfare in the future, which the Republican Party might be nervous about this and say, well, we are the party in power really throughout the United States, both on the federal and the state levels. And if a foreign government wants to destabilize democracy, well, they're going to go after the party in power. And if that's something to be afraid of, we should really have a committee to make sure that our electoral system is protected and we should investigate maybe putting up something independent of the current structure.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman, can we say which of the paths being debated in Washington toward an investigations or more than one is likely to be more effective, better informed, less partisan, get to the root of the issue?
Well, you really can't predict that, and especially on this particular issue. So McConnell is arguing that, you know, we should use the regular standing committee structure. You know, one of the things that a select committee would do would be to subtly elevate this issue, where you have the focus of, you know, it's special in some sense. You have the focus of the media rather than being on three or four committees doing hearings, this one committee. Select committees can also make careers in terms of Congress. Harry Truman first came to the attention of Franklin Roosevelt by chairing a select committee in the Senate on defense contract overruns. And so these can be focusing issues in terms of the agenda, the media, what's going on. And that may be one reason why McConnell, you know, says he's okay with the standing committee structure and using that, because it's more decentralized and you have these various committees picking up pieces of this kind of investigation. What can change McConnell's mind if there's enough pressure put on him, both through members of Congress or members of the Senate in particular, but also the American public? Now, again, this is, as Dave mentioned, kind of in the weeds, so it would be unusual, I think, for public pressure to play much of a role here. But certainly he can have a lot of internal pressure from his people in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. President-elect Trump has called the reports of Russian hacking ridiculous, in his words. His transition team has dismissed the CIA assessment, saying it is the work of the same people who claimed Iraq had weapons of mass destruction before the U.S. invaded. They did not have weapons of mass destruction. More recently, Trump's team has said they would like to see a full report before rendering a judgment. Keep that word ridiculous in mind. That's Trump's words for Russian hacking. Let's go back to 2014. This is some of Donald Trump calling into Fox and Friends, a Fox and Friends interview on Fox News. The host shared a clip of FBI Director James Comey expressing concerns over Chinese hackers and then asked for Donald Trump for his thoughts. This is back in 2014. Let's listen.
Well, I think that's great. I mean, I think what he said is fantastic. I've been talking about China for a long time. You know, they put on the front, like, we're your friend and everything. And in the meantime, the cash comes out of your back pocket. It's disgraceful what's going on with China generally. No, I think he's 100% right. It's a big problem. And we have that problem also with Russia. You saw that over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Russia's doing the same thing. Problem with the Internet and, frankly, computerization is that there's always some genius that can figure it out.
Okay, Russia doing the same thing, according to Donald Trump, in 2014, the hacking. But in 2016, he calls it ridiculous. Dave, can Donald Trump continue with his stance in the face of all the evidence from his own intelligence community, the U.S. intelligence community, that the Russians did not have this as an aim?
I don't think we've seen any evidence that Donald Trump has held to factual reality yet. He says what he wants to say and has this rather amazing ability to not be held accountable for it. He's changed issue positions on almost everything he's talked about. He agrees or disagrees with things depending upon the day of the week. I think he can keep this up. The big question is, what is he going to do once he actually has to start governing and making decisions?
Right. And Donna, what are the repercussions of Donald Trump not trusting the judgment of U.S. intelligence, for instance?
Well, you know, the American government is too big for one person to govern. It doesn't take one problem solver. It takes a lot of people, and a lot of those people need to be experts as well. But, you know, Marco Rubio earlier, and this was before the election, was on record as saying, you know, we as Republicans should stop being gleeful about these hackings into the Democratic National Committee, because this could happen to us at some point. And, you know, that is the thing that I think could marginalize Trump on this issue, in that members of Congress here, and we've seen with their statement, you know, particularly with McCain that you mentioned, but also Lindsey Graham, taking this issue really seriously. And they can become into conflict with the White House on this particular issue. And, you know, they're the ones that set up the investigations. And there is separation of powers in this country for a reason. I think that's one of the big questions going forward into the Trump administration, is how much will Congress simply fall in lockstep with Trump, and how much will they be an independent institution as they are supposed to do? And this investigation may, in fact, be one of the things that we see clarify that to some degree.
Donna Hoffman with us, Dave Anderson. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. The final 10 minutes of this Politics Wednesday, the final Politics Wednesday of 2016. We'll have some special programming on next Wednesday. Let's talk for the last few minutes about the Democrats, the position that the Democratic Party finds itself in. Here's some Barack Obama. We've been listening this week to NPR's Steve Inskeep talking at length with the current President Barack Obama. Here he is discussing with Steve Inskeep his post-presidency plans.
I'm less likely to get involved in all the nuts and bolts of electioneering. In that realm, I'm much more likely to just give advice. What I am interested in is just developing a whole new generation of talent.
Okay, a whole new generation of talent. Dave Anderson, does the Democratic Party have a void there in some parts of that generational growth?
I think there's an enormous emerging donut hole in the Democratic Party. If you look at the leadership almost across the party, it is people in their 70s, Barack Obama exempted. The House and Senate leadership are all rather older individuals, and they have just been absolutely decimated in this last decade in state-level and local-level leadership, which means the 40- and 50-year-olds who usually form the bulk of a party are just missing in elective office. However, they seem to be flush with millennials. The younger generation is strongly trending towards the Democratic Party, and there probably is young talent ready to emerge. And Barack Obama seems like his goal is to get them to emerge and to emerge quickly.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear the voice of one of the most popular Democrats in the country, a Democrat who's never run for office, nevertheless extremely popular, in an interview with Michelle Obama last week. Oprah Winfrey asked her about her future plans.
Would you ever run for office?
No.
I have to ask it.
No. It's not something that you cavalierly just sort of ask a family to do again. Maybe because we got it wrong or we think we got it wrong. So it's like, well, now you do it. You just go back in there and do it. You're the closest thing to that. So you do it. But let me just tell America, this is hard. It's a hard job. I said it on the campaign trail. It requires a lot of sacrifice. It is a weighty thing. And it's not something that you even look to one family to take on at that level, you know, for that long of a period of time.
Okay, Michelle Obama with Oprah. Oprah Winfrey, your prognosis for the Democratic Party, Michelle Obama's words there, Donna.
Well, I think it's pretty clear she's not going to run. But nevertheless, you know, we do want to put the Democrats' loss in perspective here. So Hillary Clinton still won the popular vote almost by 3 million votes. Now, again, that doesn't get her the presidency, but it also doesn't mean that Donald Trump has a mandate. More people voted for Clinton than voted for him. That needs to be part of the calculation. The Republicans in the Senate lost seats. The Republicans in the House lost seats. Now, again, they are going to control both chambers. That is a big deal. But it is not all doom and gloom for the Democratic Party. It at the state level, and we saw this in Iowa, I think they have bigger issues. But going back to this kind of notion of the leadership challenge, the Democrats are kind of at a turning point. So Nancy Pelosi, in her leadership of the House Democrats, was challenged several weeks ago by a younger Democrat. She, of course, won, and she won handily, but I think it was 63 of the Democrats in the House voted for her challenger, Tim Ryan. And that is a wake-up call to that older leadership, and there was even some movement in terms of bringing some of the younger members of the House into some of the leadership structure and trying to do some reforms to make them more happy, because there has been a sense, I think, in the House leadership on the Democratic side that, or in the House rank and file, I should say, on the Democratic side, that the leadership needs to do some adjusting. And the loss there, in which, the you know, at one point we were talking about potentially the Democrats being able to take control of the House. So I think that you must put where the Democrats stand right now into proper perspective. And, you know, a few tens of thousands of votes in three states, we would be talking about the extraordinary campaign that Hillary Clinton won and that the Democrats, you know, did. It's all very black and white in American political culture right now in terms of winning and losing. And politics is about nuance. Governing in particular is not campaigning. Governing is complex. It's hard, as Michelle Obama talked about. There's a lot of sacrifice involved. And the country has some enormous challenges, I think, going forward. And that extends both to the Democratic Party, but also to the Republican Party as well, because they also have their fissures that we saw quite dramatically during this campaign that have simply been papered over due to the fact that they hold the White House now.
Dave Anderson, what do the Democrats, what can the Democrats do to win back? And that was a big surprise in this election, the loss of so many blue-collar workers in Midwestern states to Donald Trump.
Well, I think right now the Democratic Party is kind of in a period of mourning, and they're maybe overblowing some of their fears. They did lose a lot of working class white Democratic voters who voted for Trump, but the Democratic Party as a whole seems to still have stronger trends forward than the Republican Party. The Democratic Party is younger. The Republican Party is older. The Democratic Party tends to cater towards minorities, which is the growing segment of the American population, whereas the Republican Party relies on a white base, which is a declining part of the electorate. The Democratic Party lost in 2016 for a variety of reasons, one of which is that Hillary Clinton was a rather unpopular figure. For 30 years, she's been in the public eye, and almost every American has heard some complaint about Hillary Clinton over the last three decades, and just a combination of factors led to her to lose the election. I think the party moving forward really has to just not overblow it. Yes, they have to talk about jobs, but they did talk about jobs. The fact is, I think a lot of the job talk that resonated in the states that wound up mattering were things about bringing back manufacturing and bringing back coal jobs that are really not likely to ever come back. And the reality of that is going to set in eventually. And I think the Democratic Party still has a stronger path forward than the Republican Party. But both parties face challenges about what they fundamentally stand for. I think the big story out of 2016 is that things are going to change. The conversation politically in the United States is ready to change.
Ellen on our Facebook page answered our challenge this hour. Six words or less, your takeaway from 2016. She says the whole year felt hacked. Now I'm going to turn to Donna and Dave as we look back to 2016 very quickly before we end the hour and ahead to 2017. Donna, you start. Your biggest takeaways from the political year that almost was.
I hope you're not going to keep me to six words.
No.
This was a really unusual election year. Very unusual. Certainly the most unusual in my lifetime, and I think, you know, going back even unusual beyond that. The question becomes, is the Trump phenomenon, which can be, you know, framed in a lot of different ways, is it an anomaly in our electoral system, or is it a new era? And we can't answer that question yet. And there are some troubling aspects in terms of if this is a new era. And the one thing I would focus on is the norms in American politics. There were a lot of norms of American politics broken in this particular cycle in terms of transparency, in terms of civility, in terms of political discourse. And that is the question I think that I have going forward, is to what extent do we see Donald Trump being such a different candidate, or is he going to be the model by which future campaigns, you know, run? And quite frankly, I think he's an anomaly. We're not going to be advising people in Iowa in 2.5 years or 2 years in terms of running for the Iowa caucuses. Yeah, do what Donald Trump did. Just, you know, don't organize. Don't get any kind of ground game. Just go and do big arenas.
And insult groups wherever,
right, exactly,
wherever possible.
And that is not a winning strategy for anybody other than Donald Trump.
Okay.
I think he's an anomaly, but
okay.
Time will tell.
Donna, I'm going to cut you off because Dave Anderson gets the final 40 seconds here with his thoughts on 2016 going into 2017.
Well, my six words, I think, is where we are in 2016 is forget the hope, bring the change, because I think that's what the electorate said this year. Obama was elected in 2008 with hope and change and the idea that we need to reinvent government. And largely the Republicans in Congress prevented his vision from coming through, and I think the country is seeking massive change. The Republicans now control Congress and can put in their vision of change. The big question going forward is Trumpism and his shattering of American norms going to be desirable over the long term? Are some of the changes of the Republican Party are likely to put through, things like Social Security and Medicare reform, is that really what we want? We'll find out.
Okay, we will indeed, and we hope you'll be on board. We We'll invite you certainly back in 2017. Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor, Head of the Department of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, Dave, thank you for stepping into our studios today.
Thank
you,
Ben.
You're welcome.
Happy New Year to you. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.